comments by U.S. State Department officials about recent protests in Mexico, accusing the State Department of meddling in his country's affairs. This relates to an incident of these last days. Tens of thousands of Mexicans took to the streets to protest against measures pushed through this month by President AMLO to shrink the country's independent electoral authority. At this point, I stop and turn to my colleague and friend, Evan Ellis, because the electoral authority reminds me that AMLO has been working very carefully to build a faction that will sustain his initiatives beyond his presidency. Have I said all that correctly, Professor? Can you explain what the president of Mexico is thinking about this electoral authority?
Absolutely, John. First of all, while many rightfully see anti-democratic tendencies in AMLO's desire to basically strip the current independent electoral authority of the personnel and the offices that it has to oversee elections and also take away some of the institutional independence that is traditionally had, we have to go back to the important role that there's a personal dimension in this. So in 2006, that same electoral authority in an election which was eerily similar to what we had in the United States between Al Gore and George Bush. You may remember the issue that was decided by the Supreme Court on issues of hanging chads and things like that. Something very similar happened in Mexico, where again the electoral court at the end of the day made a technical decision that in a very, very close race about the same time denied AMLO of his presidency. And so from that date, 2006, you could say that AMLO, who then went 6 weeks to protest and calling himself the legitimate but denied government, has always kind of had it in for the CNE, and he saw the CNE as a tool of elites. And so as AMLO has come back into power this time around with his movement Morena and the legislative power, one of, I think, his personal as well as electoral goals has been to do away with that institution that he saw as a key of the elites. Now, people who are AMLO's opponents and many Mexicans in general would see it not just as a personal matter, but as a matter by AMLO and Morena to perpetuate them in power. Because if you basically strip the CNE of its independence and its ability to verify elections across Mexico, and we're talking about 85% cut in personnel, we're talking about closing offices, we're talking about legislative changes in terms of the autonomy of the CNE and its leadership, that the issue is this would create a lock-in effect. Indeed, there was initial attempt to do even more broad-ranging reforms that basically failed to get the two-thirds majority that they would have needed in Congress last December. So this is what they call Plan B, the second attempt to do so. Again, many Mexicans, even those who are supporters of AMLO, but who also are supporters of democracy, have been indignant. And so Mexico's kind of principal town square, if you will, the Zócalo, you had, some would estimate as many as 100,000 protesters out in the street wearing pink, which is the color of the INE, saying that, they do not want this change. They value the independence of that electoral body, and they are resistant and uncomfortable, however popular AMLO might be, with a lock-in effect that would allow not only AMLO and Morena, but really other future governments to perpetuate themselves in power without electoral checks, going back to what Mexico lived for over 70 years when you had the previous party, the PRI, which was dominant and dominated institutions in the country.
The quote from the president is that the comments from Washington are a, quote, bad habit and also quite contrary to messaging from U.S. President Joe Biden. López Obrador is extremely popular. You mentioned as that. And he's accusing the U.S. of meddling. And to an outsider, that would be me, because this is all new to me. It does look like the State Department is presuming a deal. There's no question that AMLO is popular. This is not a brute or a dictator or a man holding on power in some fashion. He's a very careful supporter of democracy, and he uses the tools that are available to him, big projects. Well, let's go to one. Tesla. Here's the news. Over these last days, I believe we talked about it last week. I'm sure we did. Tesla's looking to move a factory into a northern province. And there was a dispute with AMLO as to whether the water supplies were adequate. You mentioned that this looked to be a negotiating principle because AMLO wants to develop the south of Mexico, where the poverty is crushing, and suggested to Musk that he could build his factory down in the Yucatan, I don't know, very far from the American border. Well, Musk, being a whimsical businessman, said, why would I want to do that? I'm, you know, up here in the north is where all the customers are. It looks like they've resolved that. And it occurs to me that AMLO has a sense of humor. He's dealing with Elon Musk, which is something the American administration struggles with all the time. And AMLO is looking very popular. And the general opinion of young people these days, Evan, you know this, you have young people at home, is that if it's okay with Musk, it's okay with me. AMLO just got a big endorsement from the richest man in the solar system. That's got to be an advantage when he disputes with the State Department.
Well, that's a great point, John. But as Musk learned with Twitter, you win some and you lose some. You're not always as invincible as you think. With respect to the State Department, just a quick point. I think it's important to recognize that in February, you actually had a vote in the Mexican Senate, which is really kind of the final vote. It passed by 72-50, approving these INE reforms. And so this really is a done deal. And for me, with the number of different Mexican actions actually against U.S. companies, you can go back to Semper Energy, you can go back to some of the issues with moves against the imports of U.S. yellow corn. You can go back to other violations of USMCA that have been downplayed by the Biden administration. There are issues with respect to Pemex. There are issues with respect to the treatment of U.S. companies in the electricity sector. Many, I would say, certainly on on the conservative side of the spectrum in the U.S., would feel that the current administration has really given kid gloves to AMLO in some of his nationalistic policies that have hurt U.S. businesses. So it was somewhat reassuring that, at least in the name of democracy, that there have been some statements against what appears, I think, to be many to be one step too far with respect to moves against democracy in Mexico. But it is interesting also the power, as we've talked about in the show before, John. AMLO is a bit of a kind of old Chicago style machine party boss. That was his style as the mayor of Mexico City, and it continues to be his style now. And so this idea that he can use his influence over institutions to kind of jab and influence where big businessmen locate their businesses, negotiate that they move it into areas that are dominated by his supporters, that are an economic need, like Hidalgo, as opposed to in Nuevo León, where it probably makes, in terms of the logistics, more sense to put it. So apparently there was a call between Elon Musk and AMLO. I wish I could have been a fly in the wall for that one. But at the end of the day, after what appeared to be threats by AMLO that he wasn't going to let them put it there, and actually AMLO's success with some other country companies, including Constellation Brewery, which actually basically bowed to AMLO in their own plans to put a plan in Veracruz where AMLO wanted it rather than in Baja, Mexico, where they wanted it. But it looks like Elon Musk won this round. It looks like he was able to get an agreement promising certain things to get the plant put in Nuevo León, where it makes more sense for Tesla, rather than in Hidalgo, where apparently AMLO wanted to steer it, having used this issue of a lack of water as a source of leverage for where he wanted to steer Musk to put the plant.
Yes, one Mexican official, Reuters reporting, said a gigafactory that would produce the semi-truck, the Roadster sports car, and other vehicles. Model Y is Tesla's best-selling SUV. These are just coming online in the U.S., too. I watch them here in rural Connecticut, Professor. It's quite fun when a Tesla flies by. You think to yourself, how many have I seen these days? And sometimes when I'm in a neighboring village, I wander up and down the street, and, it's a popular place, Kent, Connecticut, and count the Teslas versus the Volvos and the Mercedes. It's a striking fact. And now that Tesla's moved to Mexico, this makes a very clear case that AMLO is developing his economy away from the single issue, which is fossil fuel that's dominated these last centuries. Let me put my reservations about the State Department picking a fight with AMLO another way. Who is the grandfather leader of the Americas? Is it AMLO in Mexico City? Is it Lula da Silva in Brasilia? Is it Petro, the rising star in Bogota? Is there a choice that people make in their minds when they hear about these successes, Tesla's gigafactory?
Well, I think each of them would like to be the grandfather leader of the Americas, John, and they tend to have influence in different domains. And so certainly Mexico has traditionally wedded itself, at least since NAFTA in 1994, to the U.S. economy. Although going back to President Luis Echeverria in the 1970s, Mexico had postured itself as independent of Washington and willing to engage with others like Russia and Cuba, and sought to exercise its historical influence over Central America and in the Caribbean. And so I think certainly AMLO wants to position himself as a leader. He's tried to position Mexico in terms of negotiations with the Maduro regime over democracy in Venezuela. He's tried to position Mexico in a way that would allow it to maybe play a role in peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, although that's certainly not going to happen. But then, as you point out, Lula da Silva, Brazil being half of South America, half of the economy, half of the population, armed forces that are bigger than the rest of South America's armed forces combined. Lula, although Brazil has been traditionally separated from Spanish-speaking Latin America by its Portuguese language and in separate traditions, but just the sheer weight of Brazil when it wants to engage and Lula's leftist credentials interfacing with other leftist leaders. We can remember that initially the convention of essentially Latin American leftist groups known as the Sao Paulo Forum was started by Lula's Workers Party, the PT, back about 20 years ago. So you have Lula, you have the outspoken leader of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, also with aspirations with his M19 background to be the leader of the left. You have the principal Gabriel Boric, with some aspirations of his own. So I think you have lots of people who would like to imagine themselves as the leader of the left. And at the end, it's a little bit of everyone and no one as a whole. But that jockeying for leadership, and whether it's a democratic or authoritarian, radical or less radical, as we saw with the spat over Dina Boluarte and the reaction in the region, I think that those fights within the left, and frankly, the path that all of the left is taking, not only towards the United States, but the questions of their relationship with other actors such as China. This has really become the new strategic political space that's defining the region right now.
Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. He mentions Gustavo Petro. We're headed to Bogota, not because Gustavo Petro is dominating with some sharp decision, but because Gustavo Petro has, let me use the vernacular I used before, picked a fight with Ortega of Nicaragua. So two Central American states in the news, Nicaragua for expelling political opponents and jailing a bishop, and Panama for its jails, its horrible-looking jails. No matter what these men have done, they're being treated as less than human, and it's peculiar. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
What happened to her, Mario? How could she simply disappear after she was with you?
I don't have answers for that.
48 Hours at CBS News present.
I'm just going to ask you straight out. Did you kill Christy Wilson?
No, I had nothing to do with her disappearance.
Another season of My Life of Crime with Erin Moriarty. Award-winning correspondent Erin Moriarty brings you face-to-face with killers.
I will never say that I'm a cold-blooded killer. I'll never say I'm a murderer.
And the people they took from.
My son died running for his life.
This season, follow the evidence with Erin, beyond the speculation, including in the death of boxing legend Arturo Gatti.
My gut says I don't think he would take his life.
I know. My husband killed himself.
Listen to My Life of Crime from 48 Hours on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm David Pogue from CBS Sunday Morning. In the new season of my podcast, Unsung Science, you'll meet the discoverers of Ernest Shackleton's shipwreck, Endurance, lost beneath the Antarctic for 100 years.
It looked like the day when it sank. It's just a very good environment down there to conserve a shipwreck.
The woman who invented forensic genealogy and has solved over 150 cold cases.
It's controversial, right? Because you never know if sitting around your Thanksgiving table, there's somebody who's been getting away with murder or rape.
And the NASA engineers who flew a helicopter on Mars.
The density is 1% that of Earth's. 1% air density. It sounds impossible, and it is almost impossible.
It's season 2 of Unsung Science, presented by CBS Sunday Morning and Simon & Schuster. Listen to Unsung Science on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.